This podcast is brought to you by Intrepid Travel, the global leaders in immersive, sustainable, small group travel experiences. Take yourself away from the world you know and be open, curious, fearless, and challenged. Be intrepid. Visit intrepidtravel.com to book your next trip today. There's something both beautiful and highly intimidating to me about going to the ends of the earth. About setting sail for the poles, tackling rough seas and freezing temperatures to experience our world at its most remote and pristine. The North and South Pole are places of true extremes, of experiences both wild and unpredictable. And yet, as difficult as they are to access, and as challenging as they are to visit, both the Arctic and Antarctica are becoming increasingly popular tourist destinations. Cruises south to Antarctica are booming. Journeys into the Arctic Circle are becoming more frequent. What is it about these hostile places that entices people? What makes them great? And how can you get there too?
Mesdames et messieurs, départ de votre star est imminent. Attention à la
traversée. Hi, I'm Ben Groundwater, and you're listening to Flight of Fancy, the traveller.com.au podcast. Today, I'm lucky to be joined by two proper adventurers, two polar explorers who are going to share with us what's great and what's maybe not so great about the North and South polar regions. We're going to talk about encounters with wildlife, encounters with Ukrainian scientists, blizzards, glaciers, and heavy, rough seas. And we're going to do that with these two guys. First up, he's been to Antarctica more than 120 times, been to the Arctic more than 30 times, he's ridden a motorbike across the Arctic Circle, and was part of the first Australian crossing of the Northwest Passage, which I guess makes him an expert, David McGonigal. Hi, David.
Hi, Ben.
Great to have you on board. Also with us, he's a filmmaker who has just returned from the only successful eastbound crossing of the Northwest Passage in 2018, Tim Shirodi.
Hey, Ben.
Hi, Tim. Great to have you guys both here. I feel like I'm in the presence of true explorers here, which is a little bit intimidating.
I need to correct you on one thing. You said the first Australian crossing of the Northwest Passage.
Yeah.
Well, Sir John Franklin, who was the governor of Tasmania, had a try at it, but that failed miserably. So I always say the first successful crossing.
Right. Okay. Yeah. All right. Fair enough. Good to have that cleared up. David, what's the fascination with these regions for you? Obviously, it's a bit of an obsession, I suppose.
It became that way.
Yeah.
I always wanted to go there. But as a kid, I always thought that I would get to the moon, but I never thought I'd get to Antarctica.
Right.
And it's turned out to be the other way around. And I remember the
So far, yes.
Yeah. I remember the first time I was going down there and I was waiting to get the bus out to the ship out of Christchurch in New Zealand, and my legs were shaking. I was so excited. And by that stage, I'd been a travel writer for 10 years.
Yeah.
I'd got used to traveling everywhere else, and just the thought that I was going to Antarctica was beyond belief.
So it must be from ever since you were a child, you must have been interested in it, surely, to have that sort of reaction to going down there.
Yeah, and I think that's the way it is, that a lot of people, when they hear I've gone to Antarctica a lot, the world's divided, I think, pretty well equally. When people go, why would you want to go somewhere that cold just to see some penguins? And the other half going, I've always really wanted to go there. I can't imagine what it must be like. I really want to go.
Yeah, right. How about you, Tim? How did you end up exploring the Arctic?
Oh, I guess it was just kind of luck. I don't know. I was living on this boat in the Pacific for the past year, and that boat just so happened to go on to complete the Northwest Passage.
Yeah.
And I'm a filmmaker, and they decided they needed an extra filmmaker on board to film the documentary. So I just stayed on the boat and ended up going all the way through the Northwest Passage.
Yeah, right. So had you had an interest in that part of the world beforehand, or did you just find yourself there?
It's always been something that's tickled my fancy and seemed, I suppose, like you said, it's kind of like going to the moon, something that just seems so far out and so unobtainable that I'd never actually get there.
Yeah.
I thought maybe I might get to Greenland one day, whatever, but I never thought that I would go so deep into the Arctic wilderness that we did. And got through the Northwest Passage and I can't believe it. We turned out to be the only boat that got through eastbound this year. Only one other boat got through the other direction as well.
Right. Is it a primal thing going to places like this? Because there's really nothing else out there. There's no civilization or...
It's one of the very few places in the world where humans are irrelevant.
Yeah.
That you can only survive with all the the things from the modern age. You need the gear, you need the heating, you need the mechanical equipment or whatever to support you. You can't just be dropped there and think, oh, I can get away with surviving here.
Yeah,
You won't. So, and that just makes it so special. So a bit like, as I said, going to the moon, it's a bit like that.
Yeah.
But, of course, I've only been there in summer, but when you're in winter, you are completely isolated. There is no way out. If you're one of the scientists down there, you're signing on for the duration until the ship arrives, if the ship arrives, to pick you up next year.
Yeah. Did you find that, Tim?
Yeah. I think for me, it was just the, like, you genuinely do feel like you're surviving when you're in these areas.
Yeah.
You know, every decision you make is critical. Mm-hmm. You know, we're on this boat making a decision. Do we go down this passage? Do we hide behind this iceberg? Is there a north wind coming that could push the entire polar ice sheet and sandwich us between the ice and the land? Like, we're making decisions that really did carry the lives of everyone on board with each decision we made. And there's no room for gray ground. It's black and white. The decisions you make there and then, you got to make there and then. And you have to make the right decision, because the other, like you could die.
Yeah.
And that's the reality of these situations when you're sailing through.
Did you find that a thrilling sort of thing to be in that position?
I loved it, yeah. And it's kind of one of the few times in life when you can really feel at the whim of nature, you know, like you're dealing with these intense elements, ice, wind, storms, crazy, everything about it is just so intense that you have, like I was saying, you have to make the right decision. You have to be so sure of yourself and so sure of your abilities and so sure of the strength of the boat that you're on and the abilities of the crew, because it's critical. Every situation you're in is critical up there. And like you're saying, primal, I think there might have been a primal aspect to the enjoyment of that because you're actually really genuinely putting yourself at the whim of nature.
Yeah, you against the world.
Yeah, which is a special feeling.
But having said that, on the other hand, you'll have like weeks and weeks of bluebird days, clear blue skies, no wind, just everything shining and gleaming and all the creatures looking wonderful. And you're kind of thinking, God, those Antarctic explorers must have been soft. This is great.
Well, I know the Drake Passage, which we're going to talk about that later, it's notorious for rough seas. But when I went through there, it was the Drake Lake. There was, you know, barely a ripple on the surface.
You got ripped off.
Some would look at it that way. But look, let's start off talking about Antarctica, David. It's become a really sort of almost mainstream tourist destination, hasn't it? It's a really popular place to go.
It is, and you'll see ads for it everywhere. It's still quite an expensive destination, but you're still only getting 50,000 visitors there a year. So probably as many people go to visit Wagga as go to Antarctica.
Right. And the ships that are down there work together to ensure that you don't actually see another ship down there, don't
you? Yeah, there's an association called IATO, the International Association of Antarctica Tour Operators.
Yeah.
And you lodge a program before the season saying this is where the ship's going to be every day.
Yeah.
And you can make changes to that as long as you don't encroach on where anyone else is.
Yeah.
And so you just do your very best to stay out of everyone else's way.
Yeah.
If everyone is running on schedule, then you hardly ever see another ship.
Except
there's a couple of bottlenecks along the way. Obviously, Ushuaia, which is the departure point.
Yeah.
There'll normally be other ships around going through the Lemaire. That's kind of a very narrow passage, and you might encounter some others either ends of that. But
I've only done one trip down there, and we didn't see another ship the entire time. And there really was this feeling of being at the end of the earth on our own, even though, you know, probably within a few hours steaming, there was a couple of other ships around that we could have got in touch with if we needed to.
Yeah, and there's your expedition leader was just doing a great job and probably flat out on emails going, whatever you do, can you stay around there until we come through?
And I'm sure we would have passed each other at night when they were moving around. What are the different ways that people can see Antarctica? Obviously, you have to go on a cruise. Is that an expedition cruise? Is that the only way to get there?
You can always, Croydon Travel, of course, you can always do the flight over.
Right.
And looking down on it, you get a really good picture of the geology and the glaciers and all, but you don't get the feel. You can't see the wildlife, and the wildlife is such an important element.
Yeah.
But it's a great introduction, and it's nice and warm, and you get Qantas drinks the whole way there and back. And 14 hours, you're back, and that's your polar adventure over.
Yeah.
Then the traditional way is, of course, sailing down, as I said, out of South America, a bit more out of the Falklands these days. And the third option these days is you can fly into King George Island and then join a ship there. The ship's kind of based there for the season, which sounds like a really tempting idea, but it's still Antarctic weather. So if the weather's bad, you can find yourself stuck in Punta Arenas in Chile for several days waiting for your ship to or for a plane that can take you to join the ship.
Yeah, right. Okay. And how are the generally the expedition crews, how are they structured? What do you do each day? How does it all work?
It's 24-hour daylight.
Yeah.
So it could be carte blanche. You could do whatever you like. So everything's kind of structured around mealtimes. Mm-hmm. So people are woken up. There's breakfast. There's an excursion in the morning. Come back, have lunch, excursion in the afternoon. And then depending what's happening, you can either be out kind of cruising around on the ship through areas in the evening, may actually do an evening activity.
Yep.
A lot of the ships do some camping. So one night in the voyage, there'll be opportunity to go and camp ashore, which
yeah,
is
right,
a,
okay.
And when we're back onto survival there, Tim. So it's kind of, it's pretty, it's kind of rudimentary camping.
Yeah.
But you can say you've actually slept on Antarctica.
What are the nighttime temperatures there? Must be pretty chilly, isn't it?
No, it's because it's summer and because it is kind of bright all the time, the temperatures in Antarctica, on the Antarctic Peninsula, are between, say, -2 and +3.
Okay.
So no, that's not it's so not bad. So think Thredbo in winter.
Right. Yeah.
Yep.
Not bad at all. Is it an expensive thing? Are there ways to do it on a budget, or do you have to spend a lot of money on this?
So there's always some deals going, mm-hmm. Whichever companies, because, you know, the company's got to try and fill the ship as much as it can.
Yep.
If you've got nerves of steel, you can always go to a Schwire and actually just look in the shop windows and see what deals are offered. And
the cruise I did was the last of the year, and there were people on board who had just turned up in a Schwire and managed to score themselves a very cheap ticket.
Yeah, there are deals around. It's kind of, for the people who paid full fare, that's kind of really annoying.
Yeah, they were annoyed.
But, you know, it's just what a lot of the companies do anyway. So you can do that. I'd really recommend if you think you're doing that, don't be there in December and January.
Right.
Because you're not going to find
a berth. Yeah, right, okay. That's peak
everything's
season,
really
isn't it?
Full, yeah.
Yeah. Right. And what are the highlights? What's amazing? I mean, for me, seeing penguins in their natural habitat in real life, you know, I'd no idea that they were such an entertaining, amazing animal. But, you know, I could sit there and watch penguins all day and not be bored. There's something really, really fascinating about them, I found.
Yeah, and there's all the different types of penguins too. So, you know, most of the penguins you see on the Antarctic Peninsula are gentoos, which I always think are kind of the Homer Simpson of penguins. They've kind of got the where they kind of fall over and
another
bit
waddle,
of ice.
Waddle around and
Whereas the Delhis look like God's first attempt to design a penguin, black, white, staring eyes, real attitude, but not as much attitude as chin straps. And they're kind of the really feisty ones. They're the smallest, but they're the ones that are likely to kind of go, get off my beach. I've just had enough of people being around.
A lot of them were molting when I was there and they just sort of sit there huddled in a little spot, just looking like FML, like what's going on here? All these things just fluffing off them and just look really unhappy about it.
And they can't go swimming, so they can't eat. They're just literally sitting there starving to death, waiting for their feathers to fall out. And you've got to be really careful when you're there to make sure people keep their distance, because if they have to get up and move because they think you're too close, that could expend the energy that's going to kind of see them through that last bit. So, and everyone's really respectful of that, I find. So if you say, if you go too close to this bird, it'll probably die.
Yeah.
People actually have a different think about it. It's not, it's not you're enforcing some rule.
Yeah.
They're actually thinking, there's a real reason behind this.
Yeah, right. I found it quite interesting on the cruise that I did. On the way down there through the Drake Passage, there were lectures all the time on board about sort of biology and geology and all these sort of different things. And people took that very seriously. You know, everyone was there to learn and find out about this sort of stuff. We stayed in Antarctica. Everyone got up very early and did all the things that they were supposed to do. But because it was the last cruise of the year, there were a lot of younger backpackers sort of style travelers on there. And as soon as we sort of turned around and started heading north back home, it was kind of like the floodgates opened. It's like, all right, now we can party. And it was a really fun time actually, which I didn't expect on board.
I've done a few Antarctic marathon voyages and it's the same thing. They are super serious till they get the marathon in, and then it just turns into the love boat.
There's a bit of that actually, which I did not expect. And another thing that we did, which I'm not sure is a normal thing that people do, was visit a research station, in this case it was the Ukrainian base that we went to visit.
Vinnytsia, probably.
Right, yeah.
Right, the old British base of Faraday.
Yeah, I'm not sure. They had a pool table there and they had a bar where they distilled their own vodka from...
Which you could exchange a bra for a free drink.
Yeah, it felt Vinnytsia. A little bit creepy, I've got to say. It was six Ukrainian guys who were locked in there all winter on their own, with surrounded by by bras that women have donated throughout the summer season.
Yes, yeah, and it's a fairly weird base anyway, because that bar, which is one of the most welcoming places in Antarctica, was meant to be a new dock when it was the British base of Faraday.
Yeah.
And the guys looked at the wood thinking, well, we could build the dock, or we could just try and do a bit of running repairs and use all this new wood they've dropped off and build a bar. So they built a bar.
Right, there you go. I like their style.
Yeah.
Can you actually get to the South Pole? Do people ever go there?
Yes, you can. And if you're saying, is there a budget way of doing it? There's not.
Yeah.
It's super expensive. I'm trying to think of the
everyday punters can actually get there.
Yeah, you do it in a series of stages. You can either do it as an adventure, something that kind of Tim's sort of seen, where you can actually fly to a place called Patriot Hills and then hike or snowshoe or ski or whatever to the pole.
Right.
From there, there's some people that are taking you to 89 degrees south, and then you ski the last 60 nautical miles, so 120 kilometres to the pole.
Yeah, right.
Which is US based there at Simons and Scott Station. And
So really there's a permanent station.
And they
there,
really don't welcome you.
Really?
So you kind of arrive, you're kept on the periphery, and then a plane comes in and takes you away again.
Wow, right.
But you can just simply fly into the pole if you want.
Yeah, if you've got the money for it, I suppose.
Yeah, and I'm thinking, I doubt if you get away with it for less than 50,000 US.
Wow. Yeah.
Would be my guess.
You've got to seriously want to go there.
Yeah.
And just quickly, you mentioned South Georgia as well as a destination that do a lot of polar expeditions call through there? What is it? It's an island?
Yeah, more and more. There's sub-Antarctic islands. And the two that are kind of best known is the Falklands, of course, which is just off South America, and then kind of the British colony.
Yep.
And then further out, and also British controlled, is South Georgia. And South Georgia lies inside the Antarctic Convergence, which is where the cold water is, which is where all the penguins and wildlife stay, because that's the source of the food. And so South Georgia is where God takes his holidays. It's the most incredible place, where you'll literally land on a beach with a million king penguins kind of stretching off to the distance. A lot of the stuff you see in Antarctic documentaries is in fact South Georgia.
Yeah, right, okay.
And so all the kind of really bright penguins are all the king penguins, and they're nearly all there.
Yeah.
So, and South Georgia is just amazing. It's like a little piece of the European Alps dropped in the middle of the South Atlantic and populated with penguins and a huge number of fur seals.
Right, okay. Yeah, wow, amazing. And what about the Drake Passage? You know, it's notorious for heavy seas. Have you been through some rough times there?
Yes, I have. People always say, what's the worst? And I say, well, when you're standing on the bridge of the ships that I work on with One Ocean Expeditions, the ship, you're standing about 18 metres above the water line.
Yep.
And I've been looking up about 6 metres to the top of the wave. So that's 24 metre.
Big wave.
So that's kind of, that was the worst.
Yep.
And everyone thinks they're going to get that all the time.
Right.
And I'd say about 10% of the time you'll have kind of a rough Drake. About 10% of the time you'll have your Drake Lake. And about 80% of the time, you know, you'll be having 3 or 4 metre waves, which is kind of a bit rolly, but certainly not bad, and certainly not a reason not to go.
Intrepid Travel run polar voyages to both Antarctica and the Arctic. So all you have to do is choose which direction you want to go. North to Greenland, Canada and Norway, or south all the way to the Antarctic Peninsula? There's no wrong answer. Each hemisphere has its merits. Ideally, Intrepid would say do both. But if you're trying to decide between polar bears and penguins, northern lights and Antarctic ice sheets, freezing cold or freezing cold, then visit intrepidtravel.com/polar for more information. Tim, let's move up to the Arctic. What were the seas? Did you have any rough seas up there? How did that go?
I mean, in the Northwest Passage itself, you're obviously surrounded by ice on one side.
So tell me about the Northwest Passage. I don't really know too much about it. Where is it? What is it?
It's a very historical sea route.
Yeah.
It was traditionally this route that They were trying to find pathway between Europe and Asia.
Yeah.
And so the famous story of the Northwest Passage is Sir John Franklin, mm-hmm. who he led a expedition of two boats, the Terror and the Erebus, and 250 sailors set out to try and find this passage, and none of them ever to be seen again.
Wow.
So they recently actually just met a guy when we're sailing through Ngoya Harbour, an Inuit man who found one of the boats. And he was just in this place down near King William Island where he goes fishing. And he said just up through the ice one day, he saw this big mast of a boat just sticking out.
Really?
And he didn't know what it was. He's got photos of him with the mast just standing there. And then they decided to dive it afterwards and found one of the wrecks of one of the boats. This was only like 2 years ago.
Right, wow.
So they're still discovering. And this like these boats went down like Franklin's expedition was in 1845, so a long time ago.
And
the first successful passage through the Northwest Passage was Roald Amundsen, who is a Norwegian explorer, also the guy that first to get to the South Pole, and he basically went straight through the Northwest Passage with a little I think it was like a 60 or a 70 foot fishing boat called the Gjøa, and went through with a bunch of his friends. Took him two or three years to get through, and since then it's just been this, I don't know, it's kind of the holy grail of sailing, I guess you'd say. To do the Northwest Passage is a big feather in the hat, you know, to be able to do it. But, like, I mean, when you're up there, you don't tend to do too much sailing as as such. Like, you do a lot of motoring because you're surrounded by ice and it's a little bit too dangerous to sail a lot of the time. So if we're talking about big seas and storms, the worst seas and the worst storms you'll get is going into the Northwest Passage and out. So
The worst it's fairly protected once you're actually in the passage.
Yeah, the worst is kind of south. Like, for us, it was coming up towards Alaska in the far North Pacific and then through the Bering Sea. We hit some storms there. And by far the worst for us was because we were quite late in the season, was coming down south of Greenland. When we went off the south coast of Greenland and we're hitting just one storm after another. It's, it's a region called the Polar Front, and it's basically just a region of bad weather. Just one storm after another just comes through.
Sounds fun.
And we got absolutely pounded.
David, what's the difference in experience from Antarctica to the Arctic?
You know, well, the geographers always say that Antarctica's a continent surrounded by ice and the Arctic's ice surrounded by continents.
Right.
But that's kind of the geographer's thing. I think the difference is there's people in the Arctic. So you do actually get, particularly going through the Northwest Passage or across the top of Siberia, across the Northeast Passage, there are locals living there that you deal with. And that kind of changes the dynamic quite a lot. In terms of in terms of wildlife, of course, penguins in the south, polar bears in the north.
Right. Yeah, one cuddly and playful, the other one.
Yeah, they're the polar bears.
Polar bears. But, Tim, you were saying the, you know, the human interaction was one of the highlights of the trip for you, was it?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah,
I mean, I suppose it's like these are people that live in such a barren, hostile environment, and their entire culture is so ancient, and they live it and breathe it every single day.
Yeah.
And like spending a bit of time with Inuit people, it's like they are a part of the environment in every single way.
Yeah.
And their entire culture and their entire existence is just in reverence of nature and the environment.
And are they essentially cut off from the rest of the world? What
I mean, less, more so. I mean, there are communities that are, but these days you'll have flights going into a lot of these small communities.
Yep.
Most of them will have skidoos and rifles and SUVs.
So
it's a different, like it's not like they're, I mean, there are some places in the north of Greenland where they'll still use like primarily dog sleds to get around and it's a lot more traditional, but I know it's changing more and more, becoming more and more modern.
Yeah, okay. And what were the wildlife experiences you had up there?
Quite a lot of polar bears, actually. We saw quite a lot of polar bears who I found out liked the smell of coffee. So a couple of times we're making coffee on the boat and we'd find a polar bear swimming towards the boat.
Really?
Which is a little bit concerning.
Yeah. Beluga whales as well?
Yeah, we didn't see them up close, but belugas, lots of walrus, lots of seals all the time.
Yeah. And that's just a thing you see around all the time, isn't it?
All the time, lots of whales. So especially in the Bering Sea, we saw a lot of humpback whales. As we kind of came into the Northwest Passage, we saw a lot of bowhead whales, so the oldest living creature on Earth. They found a bowhead whale a while ago with a stone spear tip in its blubber. So they believed it was actually harpooned unsuccessfully back in the time, and the Inuit still use stone spear tips, and it's a 250-year-old whale. So,
wow.
Yeah, quite fascinating up there.
Yeah, yeah. What's the scenery like in places like that? Is it fairly barren? Fairly, you know, I guess because it's ice, there's not going to be mountains around or anything, is it?
The Arctic, the Canadian Arctic, is fairly barren.
Yeah.
So, barren. Yeah. Yeah. So when you are going ashore, and that's kind of something you're doing with rifles things because of the polar bears. It's kind of you're hiking across the tundra and it can be pretty barren. But having said that, in the middle of summer, there's these masses of wildflowers. And you kind of think, well, wildflowers like Western Australia, these are almost microscopic.
Oh,
so
yeah.
The flowers will be the size of a pinhead.
Right.
But if you get down really close and look at them, they're just beautiful. Yeah. So I've spent like 2 hours ashore and haven't moved a meter because I've just been looking at this huge garden, which would easily fit on this table.
Yeah, right. Yeah, that's incredible. And Tim, you went to a rave on a tundra?
Yeah, very unexpected.
How did that even happen?
Wow, it was probably the biggest Inuit community up there. And we pulled in and as we do always, we anchor our boat just off the town and we go in to meet the locals and the chiefs, if there are any, and the elders, and we go and say hi to them. And so we're just hanging out with them and they said, oh, we've got a bit of a get together tonight if you'd like to come and join us. So I was like, okay, I would love to. So a lot of people were tired on the boat and so they kind of chilled on the boat, and myself and a group of people, we went ashore and got picked up by some guys in pickup trucks and driven out into the tundra.
Yeah.
And they had a DJ set up and speakers and lights.
Probably not the cultural experience.
It was really unexpected. Yeah. And they were had this big bonfire going, and it was a proper rave party.
Right. Did you find people mostly pretty friendly to
very
to
friendly
outsiders
yeah.
there?
Yeah. I think it's more that they get so few travelers coming through and so few visitors that they are genuinely surprised and flabbergasted by the fact that you're there at all.
Yeah.
Especially the year that I went through, because it was a very bad ice year. Yeah. So they didn't have really any sailors go through at all except for us and one other boat that maybe went past.
Yeah.
So they don't get visitors.
Yeah,
so they were really, really genuinely fascinated to have us around, and had a great experience with the locals. Right.
And we've had the same thing in Antarctica, where we've got to the South Orkney Islands, which are often stuck in ice. And I could not raise the base on the radio. I later found out their radio aerial had broken about a week after they'd arrived, so they had no internet for the previous 8 months.
Wow.
Anyway, so we wandered in there and I was going, sorry to arrive unannounced. They said, sorry, we haven't seen anyone since the ship dropped us off 8 months ago. We hate each other. You're welcome. Come on in. Stay as long as you like.
Yeah, right. What sort of tourism experiences are on offer in the Arctic? How do you sort of experience this place?
Much the same as in Antarctica.
Yeah.
It's still kind of, you know, ship-based. Obviously, the camping options out.
Yeah.
That'd just be kind of like meals on wheels for polar bears.
Right. So that is a genuine day-to-day concern, is it, polar bears?
A minute-by-minute concern.
Yeah,
so
right.
So every time you're going ashore there, it's like a military operation. You send the gun handlers ashore first. Yep. They clear an area where you can put the passengers.
Yeah, right.
And then they stay on the periphery and keep an eye open.
Wow.
And then there's someone making sure that there's no polar bear kind of swimming onto the beach, which happens quite a bit.
Right.
Because they're aquatic mammals, so they can just kind of swim on and kind of...
What do they do if they do turn up?
They always regard you as prey.
Yeah.
So when you're in Africa, you kind of think a well-fed lion doesn't really care.
Yeah, yeah.
A polar bear is always looking for its next meal.
Right.
And you're it.
Yeah.
So you have to regard every time you run into a polar bear, it's going to be, it could be an issue.
Yeah.
You're carrying bear bangers and things like that. So normally you just retreat.
Yeah.
Get in the Zodiacs as fast as you can and go back to the ship.
Yeah.
Or once you're in the Zodiacs, you're safe and then you can kind of stay and watch the bear.
Yeah, right, okay.
But, you know, as a last resort, well, second last resort is kind of bear bangers or kind of firing the firearms to try and scare them off. And then the absolute last resort, which happened in Spitsbergen this year, I think they had to shoot a polar bear.
Right.
Because the polar bear just was not backing off and was definitely coming into attack.
Yeah. Yeah. Did you guys have to plan for that, Tim, as well?
We're a bit more haphazard, I guess. We had a gun. We had a gun on the boat. We almost didn't take a gun with us. We were just going to use flares.
Yeah.
We're all a little bit naive about the polar bear thing, I think.
Mm.
But then we spoke to some locals. They're like, you just have to take a gun. So we ordered a gun online.
Yeah.
And so whoever went ashore just took the gun with them with a couple of bullets.
So did Amazon deliver it by drone?
I'm not sure. One of the guys on the boat ordered it to tell her to this town that we came into.
Right.
And So we're like, kind of like, who knows how to use a gun? And like two people put their hands up, like, okay, you're the gun guys. Right. And then so every time we went to shore, we'd just take the gun with us.
Yeah, right.
But our big thing was flares. We had flare guns and handheld flares. And we had so many expired flares with us from the boat that we just took them with us. And if we saw any polar bears, we just let off a couple of flares. But we never really, I mean, we saw so many polar bear prints. Mm-hmm. And when we're on the boat, we saw a bunch of polar bears. But when we're ashore, we didn't really see any. Like, I think they're a little bit, I don't know. There were fresh prints every time we went to shore, and we were sitting there having fires and everything and hanging out on the beach, and we know that they were around, but they didn't really come too close to us.
David, which countries do you go to access the Arctic? Is Norway the easiest? Canada? Where would you go?
Well, there's the two sides. So you've got the European side, which is largely Spitsbergen, Svalbard, kind of up above Norway.
Yeah.
And that's kind of flying in from Norway directly into Longyearbyen, which is the main town there, and then joining a ship there.
Right, okay.
On the other side, the general rule is kind of fly into Ottawa and then get a charter flight to wherever the ship is. And, and that's kind of whether you're going to Greenland or you may fly to Greenland then come back to Canada, because it's all kind of converging pretty close up there anyway.
Yeah, right.
And so it's kind of a charter flight to wherever the ship is then getting on from there.
Is it generally a fairly expensive exercise?
It's cheaper than Antarctica as a general rule, and there's normally not so many kind of last-minute deals going.
Yeah.
But it's one of those things that if you actually did a search online, you will find deals, particularly if you start looking now or early season when people are kind of, you know, trying to get their ships, know that they've got enough that they're going to be able to run the voyages, you'll find deals coming out.
Yeah, right.
So that'd be the time to look.
Right, okay, guys, what's the food like in those Inuit communities?
Meat.
I imagine it's not amazingly good.
It's, I mean, if you like protein, it's good.
Right.
But it's pretty much all comes from a dead animal. Like nothing grows in the Arctic.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, there are some, I mean, some of the bigger towns you'll find supermarkets where they sell fresh, inverted commas, produce.
Yep.
Ridiculously expensive.
Sort of thing. Yeah.
But believe it or not, the boat we were on was vegan. So we traveled on a vegan boat.
That would
have
been difficult, wouldn't it?
So give you a side of walrus or something and you're into it.
I mean,
how do you transport all those vegetables to
dried people? Basically everything was dried and tinned. We brought it all with us. We basically brought in all of our food. But I took any opportunity I could to eat local when I was up there, when I was ashore. So I go and eat Arctic char with the locals or seal with the locals or whatever I could. But food up in the Arctic is generally seal, muktuk, which is like a layer of whale blubber and whale skin.
Mm-hmm.
Whale meat is a big feed item up there.
Yep.
A lot of fish. They got this fish up there called an Arctic char, which is by far and above the best fish I've ever tasted in my life.
Yeah, right.
It's something in between a salmon and a trout.
Right.
And it's just absolutely beautiful. Mm-hmm. Some places they still eat polar bear quite regularly as well.
Yeah.
They eat a lot of musk ox, which is a big kind of ox-looking creature. It looks like something out of Star Wars.
Yeah.
Actually closer to a species of sheep than it is to an ox,
all right,
believe it or not.
You're a big beer drinker as well. Did you find any beer up there?
No, well, most of the communities up there are dry.
Right,
so not big into alcohol, and we definitely didn't want to be bringing alcohol ashore.
Yeah.
Some of the communities were damp, so they could actually import alcohol if they wanted to. Mm-hmm. But, yeah, it's not a big drinking location up in the Arctic because most of the communities are dry and there are some problems with alcohol, so you don't want to be encouraging that.
Yeah, definitely. Guys, unfortunately, we are running out of time, but just to finish up, I wanted to ask you about one amazing polar experience that you would recommend people to have. David, if you could just name one, what would it be?
I always say people go to Antarctica the first time for the wildlife,
yep,
but they keep coming back for the ice.
Mm-hmm.
And doing a cruise around icebergs and just the size, the shapes, the colours, it's like some Henry Moore sculptor garden kind of carved in crystal.
Yeah.
And I remember landing on a beach and there must have been a big storm and all these icebergs had been blown onto the beach and it was literally like this crystal garden we were walking amongst and it was beyond beautiful. It was something like something out of Avatar. It was the most remarkable experience just for a morning in my life.
Yeah, right. Amazing. How about you, Tim?
I'll follow him with the ice thing as well. Yeah. Disco Bay in Greenland. Mm-hmm. It's home to the Lulissat Glacier, which produces something like 10% of all the of all the icebergs that come out of Greenland. It produces the biggest icebergs in the Arctic.
Yeah.
And just to see this procession of huge ice cathedrals just come out of this bay and then just march down.
Yeah, right.
Every time you see it, every time we saw a big iceberg go past the boat, everyone would be standing on the deck with their jaws down around their ankles and just speechless, because they simply are the most beautiful, perfect, imperfect structures nature could possibly create.
Yeah,
and it's
right.
just, and each one's completely different, and each one is just a beautiful sculpture, and it's kind of humbling to see these big objects, and it's like so many of them go completely unnoticed and they just literally go off and melt off into the ocean. And each one, if you like to be humbled by that thought and just to look at these sculptures, and I think I took about 1,000 photos of icebergs. I couldn't stop.
Nicely put.
Yeah.
And I'm going to say, on the wildlife front, I would just recommend people spend an hour in a penguin colony. To me, it's just the most fascinating and entertaining and amazing wildlife experience. You know, you're told to keep a certain distance from these animals, and you do, but they're so kind of inquisitive and unafraid that they will come up and sort of peck your trousers and have a look or poke around in their sort of funny, waddly little way. And I was completely charmed and bowled over by penguins, and I had no idea that that was going to happen before I got there. But anyway, Tim and David, fantastic talking to you. Thanks so much for joining us. Really appreciate that.
Cool. Thanks, Ben.
If you'd like to subscribe to Flight of Fancy, you can find us on iTunes or your favorite podcasting app. There'll be a new episode going up every fortnight. And of course, to read some great stories about the Arctic and the Antarctic, you can find it on traveler.com.au. And we'll see you next time on Flight of Fancy. Thanks for listening to this podcast, brought to you by Intrepid Travel. Sign up to the Intrepid e-newsletter for more travel inspiration and to be the first to hear about great deals and competitions. Visit intrepidtravel.com to subscribe today.